This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
Hopefully you listened to episode 15, where in cooperation with HWM Walton-on-Thames Aston Martin, Les Goebel drove the Aston Martin Vanquish V12, and we chatted about the perceived gearbox issues and how to get the best from the car. Anyway, after all that, and with the recording in the bag, all of us being myself, Steve Waddingham, Guy Jenner and Les sat in a showroom, and with a cup of tea and some sandwiches, we looked back at the Vanquish history, where it is today, and its impact on Aston Martin. Oh, and by the way, the showroom wasn't the quietest place in the world, but in my opinion, it adds to the atmosphere. So there it is. And here it is.
Growing the passion, sharing the stories. The Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
If you go back to the 90s, the early 90s, company nearly died completely. You know, let's not forget, 46 cars were built in 1992. That was it, the entire world. So clearly, we had to do something, or rather our owners at the time, Ford, had to do something. They owned about 75% of the company. So they decided to persevere, buy the rest of the company, and invest heavily in the product lineup. And that would be a new small car, the DB7, a car that we could build in bigger numbers, sell at a reasonable price. Bearing in mind that a brand new V car back then was 150,000 or thereabouts. So the big 550 brake horsepower Vantage was the flagship of the company. Everybody loved it, but it was very expensive, sold in tiny numbers every year, maybe 50 or so cars a year. But I remember clearly one of our directors saying, we need a flagship. We can't be the DB7 car company.
That was dangerous to become
the DB7. So we needed a flagship. Yeah. But the one we had, which, let's face it, the design of that car had its roots in DB4. So the floor pan of a Vantage has got little bits in it, a bit like a Land Rover Defender. It's got a hook on the side from the 1948 model. Well, yeah. If you look underneath a V550, there's little bits of it that come out of a DB4.
Yeah.
So that whole thing had developed as far as it could go. And we're into the age of the airbag and, you know, engine emission standards were changing. So we needed a new car. So I start from fresh. So it was a big, bold move, really. And Ford, at that point, were also building up what became the Premium Automotive Group. And they could see a sudden need for a flagship for us, but also a way of using Aston Martin as a technology testbed. So let's try things out at Aston Martin, low volume production, and then those items can then make their way into the more mass market models across the whole range using carbon fiber. And things like alloys. You know, so magnesium alloys, things that are probably nowadays in the steering column of your Ford Focus, were the materials were originally used on Vanquish, and they were very expensive. And like anything in life, technology is expensive to start with. Once you find ways of mass producing it, then the price comes down.
Yeah.
It becomes more affordable. And one of the things even back then was fuel economy, emissions. Easiest way of winning on cutting emissions, make the car lighter. So make the car out of lighter materials and you're straight away going to burn less fuel. So really, this was very forward thinking. Ford were thinking we can test bed these technologies and maybe one day we'll have a mass production car bonded together, or, you know, with an aluminium bonnet or whatever it may be. So that was the thinking behind it. And that's why they could justify giving us the funding to go ahead and design and build a car that could deliver that type of technology.
Do you think it was always set to go into production? It's interesting that where they revealed the car, it was 1998, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it was a long time before the car was actually launched. I wonder whether it was kind of tested to see what the market is.
It was also, partly as well to pave the way for DB7 Vantage.
Yeah.
So if you have the bonnet of Project Vantage, the engine underneath it is effectively a DB7 engine, which was still a year off of production.
Oh, okay, yes.
So it was a way of smoke screening the new DB7 that was coming.
And Bob Dover was the chairman at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob Dover and Jack Nasser was the head of Ford, if I remember rightly. And then the sort of Premium Automotive Group, Les will remember this probably better than me, actually, was really pretty much based in London. Mm. There was an office in London, and it was headed up by Reitzler, wasn't it?
Dr. Reitzler.
Dr. Reitzler. Yeah. It was a German guy, and he came in to run the premium brand side of the Ford business. Yeah, and so and that was gaining strength in that period. So PAG eventually became it used to be called AMJLR, big Jaguar Land Rover, and then Volvo, and then in America you got Lincoln Mercury as well. PAG eventually soaked up all those brands, and Ford were really proud of it. They just loved it. You know, yeah, they made the Model T, but they also owned, in their eyes, some of the best premium luxury car brands in Europe and in the world.
And interestingly, Autocar, when they were speculating about what Aston were going to do, they had suggested the Vanquish was going to be called, the V12 Vanquish was going to be called DB12.
No.
So they got the scoop. They were a little ahead of how things panned out. But ultimately, decades. They were right long term. There was going to be a DB12 at some point. But it was a striking looking car, and it just sort of had that muscular menace to it. So it's what Aston do very well, that brutishly handsome look. And you can see in particular those rear shoulders that are sort of DB4 GT Zagato inspired. Well, that was just a lovely piece of design.
And the vertical line in the door.
Oh, yes.
That's really made that rear horn stand out.
Yeah, that's
out.
What nice edge, isn't it?
It was like a tiger going with its rear haunches ready to limp forward. It just said power.
Mm. Completely, yes. With the noise to match. I mean, we've just been watching Les drive down the road, because and for those of you that get a chance, there's a fantastic video that talks about how to drive Vanquish in its gearbox. But seeing the car today out the road, I mean, the design has just stood the test of time somewhere.
Well, out in the forecourt where there are some very, very nice Aston Martin cars of all types.
Yeah.
And yet it sat out there this morning on its own in amongst them, and it somehow just sits quite proudly in amongst all those more modern cars, and it doesn't look out of date.
No.
And it's got presence, isn't it?
It does.
It really makes you look at it. And yeah, that is, you know, genius, isn't it? Really, it's a piece of design. And I think, I'm sure if you are seeing Callum, he'll probably say it's one of his favourite designs, because there wasn't much interference. He was kind of allowed to just design it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much, we made what he sketched pretty much.
Well, yeah. I think he has such a great success with the DB7.
Yeah.
This guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So you crack on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he got, I'm sure I remember hearing him tell a story about the door handles and how the car had to then be slightly wider to accommodate the type of door handles he wanted to use. So, you know, there's lots of interesting little anecdotes like that. And of course, we were still, you know, back in those days, Ford were very much like, come and help yourself. You can have anything you like out of the parts bin from any brand that we own. Mm. Anything you like, take your shopping trolley, do a supermarket sweep, and you can have whatever you like, but don't ask for any budget to do anything that's your own.
Don't ask for anybody.
Yeah, so we were given the headlamps. The headlamps, yeah, you can have your own headlamps, because clearly they've got to be the eyes of the car. So headlamps are okay. The fog lamps were already on DB7 Vantage, so that was fine. Yeah. But then we had the rear lights, which was like, nah, sorry, you need to go and have a look in the parts store, see what you can find. And the only lights that fitted into the design of the car at that stage were off the back of a Ford Cougar, which was a European sports
coupe.
Yeah. And I think in America it was sold as a Mercury, but as it was like, they were quite bug-eyed. They were quite awkward looking, these lamps. And it was like, there you go, use them. And you can disguise them by sinking them into like a panel. So they were kind of, on a Cougar, they were big, red and orange kind of slab with two big blisters coming out of them with the lights cut into them. Whereas on the, I think the Vanquish, I seem to remember there was some kind of a disguise panel to water it down a little bit, but it still didn't look very good. And that's how the first handful of cars pre-production were made.
That was probably my only criticisms of the early design, was the rear lamp.
Yeah.
And I thought there was a few quirky bits in the interior that just didn't quite work.
Yeah, exactly.
But it turns out that was also the case as it moved forwards for getting close to production because there was a new CEO that came into the business.
Yeah,
do you remember much in terms of how that sort of played out? Because Vanquish was delayed.
Well, first of all, I remember seeing Project Vantage for the first time inside the workshops at Newport Pagnell.
Yeah.
So the entire workforce were invited to come and have a look at it. So it put into the factory where at that point we were still building the V8 cars, which were 12 weeks to build.
Right.
You know, and suddenly this spaceship has arrived and it's inside amongst all the cars being built at that moment. And at the end of the line, there's this green car. And we're looking around it and I noticed the Ford air vents, the KA air vents, which had a little bit of aluminium trim on them to make them look slightly different, but you could tell what they were, you know. So inside it was all a bit kind of bit concept car-y, bits of aluminium on show, but, you know, very, very modern. And then talking to Ian Minnars, who became the chief engineer on the car, and Ian was explaining about how it was bonded together and it got carbon fibre in it.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, wow, yeah, it's amazing. It's a concept car. Yeah, wow. What about the production one day? No, we are going to build this. What, you're going to glue it together? Yep, we're going to glue it together, you know. And it was just like, what?
When I talk to people about this Vanquish, I say this is probably the most important car in the company's history because it's the first time we've taken bits of aluminium and glued it together.
Yeah.
And that then led on to the VH platform.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, when I was designing the Dieter training for this car, I didn't meet Ian Minnars at Newport Pagnell. I met him at Heffel.
Interesting.
And who builds a car at Heffel?
Yeah.
Lotus Elise.
Yeah. So much secrecy.
There was an Aston Martin engineering team based at Heffel because that's where that technology was.
Yeah.
And it was called a little village. There was a little village, wasn't there? There was a small team of people that were living in digs, working in a village called Bolton near to Heffel. So the project name became Operation Bolton or Project Bolton.
Project Bolton, yes.
And I bumped into an old friend one day. I was at Goodwood Fest for the Speed. Would have been 98, would have been later that year. And I saw this guy. In fact, he'll be listening to this because he now owns a couple of Astons himself. But anyway, back then he was an employee. And I said, bloody hell, Dave, I haven't seen you for ages. And he said, well, I'm in Bolton. And I said, well, why are you in Lancashire? And he went, no, not that Bolton. And I suddenly realised I'd walked into something. So very quietly, a team of people were building these cars in Norfolk and testing them. And the cars were so secret, they were painted matte black. And they were tested at night time on the test track at Heffel. So the secrecy.
Brilliant.
And the Lotus test drivers nicknamed it, I think they called it Black Thunder. Because when this thing arrived on the track, it would suddenly appear and they couldn't see what it was. It was just a black object, like a stealth bomber, you know, whizzing around the track. And that's how the cars were tested on the road. That's where all the testing was done at night time. So if anybody saw it, try to get an image of it, just be a black, matte black blob with some lights on it, you know. And also, of course, we were going to, from this technology, we were going to learn ourselves how to use it. And as the project gathered steam and went into launch and everybody loved it, the next thing was, well, that's great, but how do we make a DB7 this way?
Yeah.
And that laid down the ideas for what became DB9 and the VH platform, which was a very clever idea of a set of components that could be stretched, shortened, you know, and made into a variety of different types of car. But that required an awful lot more development and a factory to build it in, which became obviously Gaydon. So Vanquish was very much a test bed. It was a concept car you could buy, and everybody knew full well that we were never going to make anything quite like it ever again. It was just so vastly complicated. It was literally a test bed that we were selling to the public.
Well, as Les said earlier, it was a very important car for Aston Martin. I mean, every car's Aston.
It set us in a direction. And if you look at the benefits of that platform, that the biggies are that is weight, but also it's just got enormous strength.
I say torsional rigidity.
Come on, yeah. Incredible. And if you look at that, how that's affected our cars subsequently, we've always had these enormously rigid platforms that have help the cars from a dynamic point of view, but also we have incredibly safe cars, and it's because there's so many wonderful things to talk about with Aston, rarely does safety get a look in, but I think we probably have all seen nasty accidents occur with Astons.
Yeah.
And the way they hold up is incredible.
Yeah. I remember a very early Vanquish being really badly pranged by an owner. And allegedly, the policeman who turned up at the scene said, "Where's the body been taken to?" And they said, "Well, he stood over there ready to talk to you." And he was like, stood there. You know, the guy was just stood there waiting to have a chat and completely unscathed, you know, because the car had done its job. It had deformed at the front as they were designed to do. And there were people's lives were saved by the design of the car. But the only problem with Vanquish is that the all of the front crash structure is amazing what it can absorb, but it's a one shot. Once it's been deformed, you can repair it, but it's a lot more involved than repairing the later VH cars.
Yeah.
But again, it didn't matter because this was a flagship. It was only low volume. It was going to be an expensive car anyway.
Yeah.
We had to work really, really hand in glove with the car repairer agencies so when you design a car, they come in and they work out your insurance premium group because they look at how long it's going to take to repair the car and the cost of repairing it. And then from that, they calculate the risk rating effectively.
Yeah.
So in order to make sure that the car was affordable to insure, we had to convince them, don't worry, these are repairable, this is how you repair it. So we would walk the people from Fatcham, where they do all this stuff, through the entire process, convince them that it was all okay, but it pretty much centered around it coming back to Newport Pagnell for repair.
Yeah.
You know, so I think virtually every Vanquish that ever suffered a severe accident would have been repaired at Newport Pagnell.
Yeah.
But they bought into it, you know, and they were like, yeah, that's fine. So, So that, you know, it's all very well making something, but it's got to be affordable to run it and repair it as well. So that was another big learning curve for everybody, but also learning that, you know, okay, it's great for this one, but we need to move the technology on for DB9 Vantage, make it even easier to repair.
If you think as well, the Vanquish was that transition from the hand-built V8 car.
Yeah.
To the DB9 and the V8 where the bonnet light comes in.
Yeah, exactly.
You had this interim period where there were guys banging the different panels together to form the boot deck because it was two panels.
Yep.
Yeah. So you got this hand-built craftsmanship going back to the V8 era with the modern technology taken to the DB9 era. It really was a transitional period.
Well, there was a pause in 2000. When production was going to end of the the big V8 models, the Vantage and the Volantes, etc., and it was a case of right, if anybody wants to go now, you can, and there was a very decent package available for people to retire early, and some of the guys went, you know what, I'm 63, I've done this for 50 years, or not 50 years, but you know, 40 years. Yeah, 150 years. So thanks very much. I'm off, you know. And other people were like, well, no, I want to relearn these skills and I'll stay.
Yeah.
And so that happened. There was a handful of people left, but the vast majority of the panel beaters were the same guys that had been building the previous cars, but suddenly they had less work to do. And they, you know, they learned their new techniques and actually they were more than happy. So if you look at a Vanquish, a boot lid was 8.5 hours to make.
Yep.
Outer, inner skin joined together, all done by hand, all finished by hand. And then the fenders or the wings, they were 4 hours each roughly and a different person making each one. So, you know, you'd have four people making four wings and one person making the boot lid. And they'd all be the good thing about them was superform. So superforming was a process we'd learned from Morgan actually. Mm-hmm. Morgan was superforming their Aero 8, etc. So you take a blank piece of aluminium, you heat it up, and when it's really, really hot, you lay it onto a one-sided former and then you cool it down with argon gas. So you kind of shoot this cold gas onto it and it while the metal is all like kind of molten almost, it kind of pushes it into shape.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you get a perfectly formed panel and there's no like bunching up that you get when you press metal. It normally, it puckers up around the corners.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very smooth way of forming a panel, but it still needed the edges dressing by hand. But the important bit was the bit where it was going to fit onto the car was the same shape every time. whereas the previous cars were made to fit. So the wings were made to fit the car, the doors were made to fit the hole between the front wing and the rear wing, you know, whereas Vanquish panels were, they were just finished off on the outer edges, but the edges where it would touch the rest of the car were preformed. So it was a genius way of making a really, you know, incredibly high level of quality on a Vanquish body, because everything is interchangeable, but equally it's got that lovely hammer finished element to it as well. So yeah, it's a unique car, never seen before, never seen again, basically.
It feels like it, as Les said, it's that sort of sweet spot where it's gone. So build time previously was kind of 12 weeks on a big 550.
6 weeks for a Vanquish.
6 weeks for Vanquish. Yeah. So yeah, that's quite a sizable shift, but it's still an enormous amount of time.
Oh yeah.
To build the
DB7s car. Were about 4 weeks. So yeah. It was a big chunk on top.
Yes.
And that's why I think, if you look at a Vanquish, and you know, the sort of thing you never read about in a magazine article, is the finish on that car, you know, the hand-painted, you know, if you open the door and lay underneath it, look up, you can see a face in the edge of the door, because they were turned upside down and flatted and polished all the way around. You know, it's pretty amazing, really.
That took 2 days, I think, to do that.
You know, a handful of people painting them, polishing them. But equally, the bit you step through, which you probably would imagine would be metal, is actually composite. So the ring of material that runs around from the A-pillar up over what we call the cant rail, which is the side rail of the car. The roof sits in the middle between the two outer sides of the car. And that whole panel is a composite panel. But underneath it, the A-pillar, that's the front piece that comes up alongside the windscreen, was a beautifully made carbon fiber, like a leg, and it was sunk into a massive, great big pool of adhesive. I mean, watching these things being built was incredible.
I mean, that's cutting edge, though.
Oh, it was 4 hours per station, because all of that to take a tub that came in from Lotus Composite, I think it was, with the carbon fiber bit in the middle, to take that and turn that into what looked like a Vanquish body.
Yeah.
You know, each operation was 4 hours. So that the production line moved every 4 hours because of that process. And it was really, really, you know, like nothing else you'd ever seen. But all of that was being done in this very old traditional factory.
Yeah.
The buildings were from the 1940s. Some of the people were from the 1930s. and all of that had to be modernized as well. So it was a massive transformation of the plant, rebuilt to build that car, to build it that way.
I heard that the Newport Pagnell, it was as like Wagner, as Vanquish was going down the production line, the building itself was following.
It was amazing. If only we could have done like a time-lapse video, because there was like a wave of painters, decorators kind of sweeping in front of,
a bit like a queen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fresh paint. Yeah. So the old cars were coming down the line in a very dark part. You know, the factory was dark because it was full of soot. You know, all the welding over the years had made everything go like black and brown. So as those cars came through, they were followed by the decorators who were then whitewashing everything, painting the floors grey, and putting all new lights in, etc. And then behind them was the first Vanquish. It was like
you're going from black and white.
Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah. Exactly how it was like. And you could almost step one side to the other and go, you know, 19th century, 21st century. And it was huge, you know. I've never seen anything like it. Don't think you'd ever see anything like that again, really. It's just such a transformation. 2001 was when it actually arrived in Geneva, so March 2001.
But it did get delayed, didn't it, by Dr. Betts being joined the business.
So originally we booked the motor show stand in Birmingham, so what would have been October 2000, we'd booked some big stand. We normally only had a 3 or 4 car stand. We had a stand that was big enough for like 5 or 6 cars. And suddenly, you know, right, forget it, we're not launching. You know, we're going to have new rear lights. So the Cougar lamps went in the bin.
Yep.
And the air vents came out, which were the KA air vents.
Yep.
So very, very rightly, and, you know, amazing respect to Dr. Betts for doing this, he took one look at the car and went, there's no way we are making that looking like that. You know,
it was the right call, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he had to go away and he had to have a big battle to get the finance for the rear lamps in particular, you know, and the air vents. They've never been the most exciting looking air vent, but they're better than what we would have had, you know.
Yes.
Much more in keeping.
What was your impression of the gearbox at the time? Was it a problem?
Never. It's a case of understanding what the car is. It's a manual car with a clutch, but there are hydraulics that press the clutch pedal and there's a shifter that changes gear for you. But I love the car. I just think it's fantastic to drive.
Yeah.
It's a technology that was coming in, and as long as you drove it as a manual car and not an automatic car, which is where people were going wrong.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It was such a rewarding driving experience, which is what we found earlier when we were driving the Vanquish around. I haven't driven a Vanquish for 15 years, and I jumped in it, and I was driving around, chatting to you, and it was just so intuitive. We didn't do the nodding dog thing.
No.
We didn't get the jerky gear shifts. And we did starts on inclines without it rolling back and burning a clutch out. It's just about understanding the car. If you understand it, it is so rewarding. And we as a performance driving course team never had any problems with the car. And once we took the people through the performance driving course, they went away with the biggest smile on their faces.
Right.
Because I've got it. Give me my car.
So it was an educational thing. This was a new thing, wasn't it, Guy?
For sure.
Customers weren't expecting this. It's an automatic. I just press the button, it'll do it itself.
You've got, and in fact, if there was one thing if I could change something about it, it would be to delete the D button. Because the moment somebody sees that D for drive, great, I just press that. Off I go, automatic.
Yeah, but that's on the Sportship 1, 2, and 3, the Varsity Advantage.
Yep.
Don't forget, on Vanquish, it's ASM.
That's true, yes.
Automated shift manual.
Yes.
It's the fact the button is there.
Yeah.
That you can, the dealer, or the salesperson, the easy way out is press that and off you go.
Yep.
D for don't.
we did actually plead with Dr. Betts when it's the Sportship 1 on Vantage. We did plead with him not to have D on that button.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're implying it's an automatic gearbox.
Absolutely
gear
that.
Right. And that, straight away, you've sent the wrong messages to the customer.
Okay.
But so ultimately, it's never been about the gearbox. But I guess also in the fullness of time, this training was taking place 20 years ago. There'll be people today selling these cars, or 5 years ago that were selling these cars, that just haven't had the benefit of the training and the experience.
Right.
To deal with it appropriately. But once you know how to use that gearbox, it's a joy. You just need to know what you're buying.
Yeah, and please, if you're listening, you've not already seen it, find the video that we've made with Les driving a car and talking through the various functions, because it's really, even if you own one, even if you think you know how to drive it, just watch it, because it might just be a little thing, one or two bits in there that you might not have been aware of, and can just make it even more pleasant to live with and to drive. So, yeah, we kind of hope that video just helped people going forwards a bit, really.
Can you remember your first drive, Sting?
Because I can remember mine.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I can remember mine. It was a rainy day. And I got told, look, just whatever you do, just be really careful because it's a bit lively in the wet. And I thought, well, don't worry, you know, I'm progressive with a throttle. It'll be absolutely fine. And sure enough, go out onto the road, two roundabouts in, just gently apply some throttle. And needed to apply a little bit of opposite lock. I thought, oh, okay, this needs respect, doesn't it? But it just, it's just such a characterful, charming car that just gets under your skin.
Yeah.
Which you put a few miles in them.
We talked about power.
Yep.
We talked about the beauty. The thing that's hard to describe, but it's got in abundance, is soul.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's this, as you said earlier, out in that car park, it just stands in its own presence.
I must admit, today I was eyeing up a flyover that we went past. I thought, we ought to really go down there, drop the windows, drop it down a couple of gears and then boot it, because that's when you get that lovely roar, which is more like from a Vulcan bomber than an ordinary car, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know,
Can I say something very naughty?
Go on.
Myself and two other instructors, we took three Vanquish out to Lommel in Belgium to do this driving event. And we were coming back in three Vanquish, and the road was blocked off, and we had to go around Antwerp. There's the biggest tunnel you've ever seen. Now, I put my hand up, and so were the other two instructors. Window down, second gear, big bananas.
Yeah.
Three Vanquish. What a sound.
It's heavy.
It must have been an earthquake.
It from, must, from a, yes, yeah.
Above, there were people's China cups rattling, I imagine, you know.
And it's a bit like the butterfly video. So one scene, we were driving through the Tyne Tunnel, and it's during the rush hour, but the police shut the tunnel, and we did the first take driving north to south.
Yep.
Then they let all the traffic through, and then, right, lads, we're going to do the second take now, south to north. Now, the Tyne Tunnel is quite tight, twisty, and I'm driving through, and the sound was awesome. But as I popped out the other side, there were people standing outside of their cars. They got off the bus. It was like, what is this sound coming towards me?
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
the Vanquish.
Coming out of a tunnel, it'd be like an explosion.
Yeah.
When you see an explosion come out of a tunnel, and it because that's a big cloud, it would be like a cloud of noise, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah.
But it's funny, you know, say about your first drive. Well, one of the downsides a bit about being... Often in my career, I've been the first person to do a certain job, like factory tours. So I had like an hour between being shown around Bloxham and my first tour coming in. So an hour to learn the script and then go do a factory tour, you know. So nobody could teach me because nobody had ever done it before.
Yeah.
So equally, when it's early days with a new model like a Vanquish, so my experience of one evening, must have been in the summertime, came out to drive home, and my friend at work said, Waddus, do you want to drive this back to Newport Pagnell?
How long does that take to think the answer?
About a split second.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, but I haven't driven one. And I knew about this gearbox. You know, he went, oh, it's honestly, dead easy. I did it today. So my handover into a Vanquish for the first time was my friend telling me how to drive it, but explaining what to do. And he just gave me the key and went, see you there. And he followed behind in his Fiat Coupe, whatever he had at the time. And I just set off in this car. I'd never driven it before, you know, and I just kind of learned the basics as I drove along.
Yeah.
And, of course, the one thing I knew, I think Les had already explained it, was you've just got to back off a little bit when you go up a gear.
Yeah.
So I just experimented, had an hour or so in the car from Bloxham to Newport to basically get it right, you know. And
but that's part of the joy, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly,
car,
yeah.
Once you get it,
yeah,
the smile on your face.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I think you've seen it time and time again when you've trained.
Yeah.
You see, I, a bit like myself, it was...
It was almost to teach you.
It was, here is a car.
Test pilot.
How are we going to train the dealers on it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no handbook for me.
Yeah.
I literally had to take what the engineers had given me and design it. Not only a performance driving course, but the dealer training course as well,
yeah.
where all the dealers from around the world were coming to Millbrook to drive this car for the very first time.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Can we mention, Liz has written a training manual on driving a sports shift gearbox. Steve will still have it. I've still got it. So if any listeners actually want a copy of it, we've got it. Yeah, we'll gladly share it. Yeah.
But again, watch it. You know, watch the video.
Yes.
And read that, and then watch the video again, and you know that will help you get the whole thing really. But yeah, and it's very scientifically explained in that handbook.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole thing was just. And I remember. So, job wise, I was at Bloxham doing factory tours. I lived an hour away. But the reason I'd taken that job in the first place was because I knew this car was coming.
Right.
Okay. So the sweetener for me was, well, go and do that job, and then you get first dibs on going back to Newport Pagnell, where you've come from, to do Vanquish. And I said, absolutely, that's what I want to do. And then when the time came round, it was like, oh, do you really want to go there and do that? Because you'll be away from everybody else. You'll be the only person there in the department. And I thought, absolutely, for that exact reason. So I was so hell-bent on being with Vanquish. I wanted to work with the flagship car. And it was everything I wanted it to be. It was fantastic. The customers, when they started coming in and do the tours with them, were all superb people and really interesting people. And I literally, the day before the first factory tour started at Newport Pagnell, I grabbed all of my bits out of the office at Bloxham, which was in those days a great big heavy PC and a, you know, and a mouse mat, all the stuff you had in that period.
Yeah.
Shoved it into the boot of a Ford Fiesta and drove, said, see ya, and just drove off to Newport Pagnell and then set up camp inside Sunnyside. So I was very lucky. I had an office inside the very iconic Sunnyside building. And that's where I stayed for the next 6 years doing Vanquish tours almost to the end. I then moved departments, unfortunately, and missed the last, you know, 8 months or so of Vanquish. But yeah, apart from that, I did a fairly big chunk of all the visits for Vanquish and loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant, you know.
And so they built, is it just over 2,500 Vanquish?
Yeah. Yeah, both types.
Yeah,
you've got a split between the, I think roughly off the top of my head, it's something like about 1,600 or so of the original car and then 1,000 or so of the, thereabouts, give or take 100, of the S version.
And then there's a sports dynamic pack as well.
Yes, and so the S was quite an upgrade.
It was. Yeah, there were quite a few.
What was that about?
Well, so first of all, power went up. So it was 460 brake horsepower. For the original V12 Vanquish, and it went to 520.
That sounds quite tiny these days, isn't it? 460.
Yeah, well, yeah, but that was old money. That was non-turbo, so yeah, you know. Yeah,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
But interestingly, acceleration was actually, 0-60 was actually slightly slower because they changed the gearing on the S because it then became, rather than 190 mile an hour Super GT, it became a 200 mile an hour plus car. Well, in fact, have you done 200 in a, have you done any high speed testing?
No.
As the year says? No.
The fastest we did at the opportunity I had was down the mile straight at Millbrook. But back then, we didn't just go onto the straight and drive down. We go to the top of the loop. So literally by the time we're on the mile straight, we're doing 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And we're doing 175 at the end.
Yeah, and so I did 175 with you down there.
Yeah,
but one funny occasion, because equally back then, so we're talking about the mile straight at Millbrook. And nowadays, it'd be a standing start.
Yes.
You know, beginning of the mile to the end of the mile. But in those days, you could go up to the top of the hill and then run down and, like you say, hit it at 100 miles an hour at the bottom of the hill. But also, you had cars coming the other way.
Oh, it's two way.
No,
oh yes, it was. Yes. So I think I was with Les, and I was, you know, mid flight down the mile straight, 130 or so, and climbing. And suddenly, in front of me is a pheasant that's just landed right in front of me. And I looked at whoever it was. It was either you or Simon Dickinson. I looked at whichever one of you it was. And the instructor said, don't even think about it.
just keep your toe in.
Can't repeat the exact words, but just hit it was the general gist of it. And I thought, oh, my God. And then as I got close, and there was another Vanquish coming towards us, so headlights were blazing away, you know, heat haze on our car from the bonnet.
Yes.
Yeah, it was really quite something. That's about Top Gun, you know.
Yeah.
And there's this poor little pheasant or I think it was a pheasant or a pigeon, a big bird of some sort, sat right in our path, like Roadrunner. And suddenly, as we got nearer to it, it decided to stand in the middle. And as we went past, we must have had a closing speed of about 300 miles an hour. And this bird was right in the middle. And we went boom, boom, boom. You know, it must have been like almost a sonic boom as the two cars passed each other. And this poor bird, I looked in the mirror and I could see like feathers, you know. So we didn't hit it, but it must have just completely scared the life out of itself. And it just kind of took off, you know. But it was just so funny. And I would neither car hit it, because if we had done, it would have come through the radiator or worse, you know.
It's not two-way traffic on the mile straight anymore.
No.
Health and safety.
It was a little bit exciting, wasn't it? 300 mile an hour closing speed or even more.
Yeah.
So we don't do that anymore. But yeah, it was proper exciting stuff back then, wasn't it? You know? Yeah.
So I was going to ask you a question in terms of upgrades, because it's probably better to talk about the sports dynamic pack, which was kind of the step towards S.
Okay.
So I had a number of modifications. So first of all, stiffer and shorter springs, so it sat 5 millimeters lower with revised dampers. It got faster steering, it was 20% faster. The front brake discs were increased to 378 millimeter, and they were 6-pot calipers, interestingly, you might know the reason for this, Les. The rear discs were 2 millimetres thicker.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if ever there was a nerdy fact, that's a nerdy fact, isn't it? Yeah. It was. And then it had lightweight wheels, which were 30% lighter.
And those calipers were massive, weren't they?
Huge stoppers.
Talk about 6-pot calipers back then. That was serious stopping power.
So that led into the S, but it didn't get any more power.
Was it called Sports Dynamic Pack?
Yes.
When did that come in? After how many years?
About 2004.
Yes. Just before S.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just to kind of, by that point, sadly, the impacts of the Top Gear program, and also just the usual, because we had a 3-year waiting list when we launched Vanquish, and then that settled a little bit, and I can't remember now, there might have been a little bit of a bit of a wobble in the economy at the time, and so suddenly sales got a bit harder, and we still had to make it to the launch of S.
Yes.
So the idea of the Sports Dynamic Pack was to give it a quick injection, a lease of life, to keep it going, to get it to the point where we could bring the S out. So
it was still less than 100 cars. It's a rare.
It's a rare thing.
Yeah.
And I think the S came out, if I remember rightly, in, I think we launched it in Paris.
Yeah.
At the motor show. And on the day we were launching it, I was speccing the first one.
Yeah.
I think, or I was doing something. I remember the first owner, the first customer, we were there doing something at the factory on the day. In fact, I think we may have even been building it. I think he came in to see it being built. Yeah, because I think we spec'd it in the British Motor Show, which in those days was in the summer in the NEC. And he walked on the stand and he was going, oh, we're going to get this, we're going to get that. And I went, right, I know exactly what you're going to have. You're going to have this, this, and this, because I predicted these colour scheme. Showed him, he went, oh, wow, yeah, I'm having that. So we ordered the car, and he was so excited. I said, you have to keep your voice down. No one knows about this thing yet. It's top secret, you know. So anyway, we spec'd the car there and on the motor show. And then by the Paris motor show, he was in to see it being built. And he was so excited about it. I said, just kind of count to 10, because nobody else, people are just seeing it for the first time, and you're actually sitting in one, it's your car. So all very early days of social media. I think nowadays it would have been all over Facebook by the end of the afternoon.
Yes, I've heard about Top Gear.
Yeah.
Heading back to the launch of the Vanquish, we've even done Sports Dynamic ODS. What was the press reception like?
I think initially they all were, wow, from the technology point of view, wow, and then when people started driving it, and then this is where Les will remember that this is where the fun started, because in those days that the old traditional media, if one prominent journalist had an opinion, then the rest would probably follow it to some degree.
Yep.
And a very well-known TV personality made this big spectacular hash of trying to drive it on camera, and that was it. And that's what started all the people panicking about, oh, hang on a minute, is this thing okay to drive? Yeah. It's a famous scene of it sliding down a slipway in a
hole.
And that's what we've reshot today on the Hill of Brooklands to show how not to do it, and how actually that doesn't need to happen if you're driving it correctly.
But for years afterwards, just saw that's the way it was.
Exactly.
It was quite interesting that straight after that filming, that TV program, head of brand Collins back at the time, Tim, bless him, he rang that certain person and said, would you like our driver to come over and show you how to drive the car properly? Can you imagine?
That went down well.
Yeah. Imagine what was coming out of the phone back at Tim, can't you?
Yeah, and there was no Twitter back then, so he couldn't tweet anything. No. Get his own back.
Yeah.
But I think we got to S, and it felt like we were starting to get past that. And I can remember there was a Top Gear with Jeremy Clarkson and Steve Coogan, and they did a twin test with, I think it was the 575.
Yeah.
Right, 575.
Yes.
And they drove them both, and they thought that possibly the 575 was a bit sharper, a little bit quicker, but it got to the end and they said, well, what would you have? And they both said, well, absolutely the Vanquish S. That's the car I would have.
Yeah.
So it was good. So it definitely felt like it got to a point where people started to understand the car more, probably understood the gearbox more, and were taken by its charm.
But the other thing we did as well to counteract all these early little problems that we had with the media, et cetera, was we went, right, you know what? We're going to give a performance driving course to the owner of every new car. So when he bought the car, embedded in the price was a day out at Millbrook, or if you're in Europe, Europe, there was a European place in Belgium.
Lommel.
Yeah.
Michigan. Yeah, probably around in North America.
So in the main kind of markets, there was somewhere you could go, or you could choose to go to any one of those three places. Lots of people flew in and did Millbrook. And that's where I came in, because I then did a factory tour before or after it, you know. And just doing that was enough to educate so many new owners that by the time they got the car, so we used to engineer it, so they'd do the PDC a month or so before they picked the car up. So they were already kind of used to drive, you know, but when they picked the car up, they'd already spent a whole day in there with an instructor. And we found that
probably more than the dealer, hey?
You know, we suddenly realized that all the problems were starting to just disappear. We also did a compressed version. So we did as a sales tactic as well, and it worked really well. We used to do these days at Newport Pagnell, mainly for UK dealers. And the formula used to be to get four customers. They come into Newport Pagnell in the morning. Two of them would then go off with an instructor each. So they'd have a car and an instructor. They go off to Millbrook. They spend the morning driving at Millbrook. The other two people would come round the factory with me. So the factory tour would last the whole morning. Then we'd meet up at lunchtime, have a lunch, like a buffet sort of lunch, in the Vanquish specking room at Newport Pagnell. And then after lunch, swap round, and those that drove in the morning did the tour and vice versa. So that way, anyone thinking about buying a Vanquish had already seen how it was going to be made, which was amazing.
Yeah.
Would be enough to knock most people over the edge into wanting one. And then the drive as well. The drive revealed all the mysteries and got rid of all the old wives' tales. So by the end of the day, they go, well, that's fantastic. I've driven it, love it. Now I've seen how it's built. Now I've got an idea what colour I want. And that would then follow with a factory tour to do the colours and then later performance driving course. So we called them mango chicken days. And the reason being, there were two old ladies that's come and do the catering for us. And one of the favourite things they'd do, all the things they'd bring in, was this bowl of mango chicken. And it was lovely, you know.
I can see your priority.
Yeah, that
tells us everything we need to know.
I was a single man at that point in time. And my entire weekly shop was based around how many of these days I was going to do in a week, normally two of them a week.
Yeah.
So I'd know that I'd be so well fed on that day, I wouldn't have to cook that evening. But we had all these lovely quiches, and it was all homemade food, that these lovely ladies used to bring them in, set them all up for lunchtime. So, of course, everybody had a fantastic day, me included, because I'd be walking around the factory thinking, oh, I can't wait for a bit of mango chicken and a bit of quiche, you know. So they were the best days of the week. And if Kingsley's listening to this, Kingsley will be laughing his head off at this point, because that's what we used to call it, mango chicken day. But they were so effective, and we'd have four cars sold at the end of each day.
Yeah.
You know, and also zero problems when the cars arrived, because they'd learned how to drive them already. So, yeah, it was things like that that made a difference. But the effect of it kicked in towards the end of the early Vanquish, the Mark One, whatever you want to call it. And then, of course, you know, thereafter with the Vanquish S. So, for the rest of the build time of the rest of the lifetime of the car was really actually ran quite efficiently,
It came to the final edition. Wasn't there a final edition of these cars?
The ultimate
one. Yes.
Yes. I bet you've sold a few, Guy.
It's the way that we phase out every Super GT, as it were, out of the range product. So that's continued ever since, that we'd have an ultimate version.
First at the Ultimus was the...
It wasn't
the DD7
Ultimus. No. I mean, limited editions really... You know, very, very much a 90s onwards thing for Aston. Things like the Dunhill DB7 and like Vanquish, Vantage at Le Mans.
Yeah.
You know, things like that were very early days of us doing a limited number or something. But with the Ultimate, there were 50 of them, weren't there?
Yeah. And they remain sought after. I mean, they command quite a premium in the marketplace.
Did they have a unique spec colour scheme or...?
Yes, but being frank, it was actually quite modest, the differences. Yeah. So, you know, it had some nice interior trim. It was a bespoke metallic black. it's a very sustainable combination. Some special stitch in something.
Yeah, it was, like you say, very, it wasn't a massive a premium, I don't think.
No.
You'd be crazy not to have bought one. But equally, it wasn't a huge amount of content, but somehow captured the imagination.
You say this car caught the imagination for very subtle changes, but it did coincide with the closure of Gimbal.
Yeah. Emotionally, yes.
End of the era. It was symbolic.
Very, but very. Yes.
I didn't think we knew what was following after that question. Didn't we? I think
gave them. Yeah, we took this with DBS to follow.
I think the Vanquish was symbolic.
Yes.
Sending a message.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think people recognized it was.
About Redundant Holiday, that's a whole bit of
thing. Yeah, I mean, we're talking symbolic. I mean, symbolic. There was a funeral procession went through the town.
No.
With a hearse, with a boat with a black top hat on in front of it, walking past the. I mean, honestly. Some people really went a bit overboard with it. Most of the workforce were more than happy because, again, there was a sort of a stepping off point. If anyone decided, well, that's it. So some people left the company and they retired and they were all up retirement age. But a lot of people said, no, I want to stay and somewhere within the company. And some people stayed at Newport Pagnell or Wolverton Mill, where the parts operation is. And some people went to Gaydon and some people are still there. You know,
right.
Or myself included, I suppose. But it was, and then the symbolic turning the lights off for the last time. I mean, talk about emotional. Wait, you know, I wasn't, but I know the man who turned the lights off. So the joke was that there's a great sense of humour at Newport Pagnell
because there was an event going on.
There was
set on the bricks.
Yeah,
that's it. The bricks.
Bricks were sold. Yes, so you could get a collection
Kingsley
of the bricks.
Did a speech.
And, big day. And lots of dignitaries and lots of employees invited to attend and, you know, a symbolic drive in the last car off the line. But actually, when everybody had gone home, the lights were on, you know, and the one person in the factory, and again, he might well be listening and laughing. So Stuart Ball, familiar name.
Yeah.
Stuart's name appears on, I would say, probably about 2/3 of most of Vanquish production. You know, if you lift the bonnet, hand-built by or inspected by, and it will have Stuart's name on there a lot of the time. And Stuart was well known for being fairly up for doing some overtime. So the joke was the last person in the building would always be Stuart Bull. So he was invited to turn the lights off for the last time. So he did. And he switched the lights off and they locked the door and that was that.
Well, let's just summarize the Newport Pagnell Vanquish.
Yeah.
If I could go around each of you and just say, what you feel has been the impact of that car and Aston Martin to the dealer network to customers, Guy? Can you, where it fits in Aston Martin history?
So, we've discussed how significant it is in terms of it being the last Newport Pagnell built car, let's say, with that era. For me, it's the change of direction and the fact that Aston kind of became this far more dynamic company. It launched the route to the VH platform that really was the seed for the next generation of cars, and it just completely changed the direction of the company. So it was a really important pivot point.
Yeah. Les, you've said it's probably one of the most important cars in Aston Martin's history. Do you stand by that?
I do, because of that technology. But I think, for me, the Vanquish, it has so much character. It is what Aston Martin is about. That car has soul. And when Dr. Yeah. Betts wrote that slogan, power, beauty, and soul, he was looking at a Vanquish. And for me, that the Vanquish, I mean, driving it today, what a privilege to drive that car. It brought back so many memories. And it has its own character.
Yeah.
You can put it with all the new Astons, and they're all beautiful. But you still look at that Vanquish, and it holds its head high.
It does.
It might be old technology. I know we've got the bonded platform, the top. But it's just iconic. I think it's.
And for me, it marks the end of one era and beginning of another. You know, that image of those decorators sweeping through the factory, you know, and the factory brightening up as it was transformed, you know, and those people staying on board to make them and knowing full well that this will be the last car that's ever made here and throwing themselves into it right up to the very last ultimate coming off the line. And I know it sounds silly, but when I look at a Vanquish, I can see a load of people looking back at me because I can see all the faces of the people who made it.
Yeah.
I get quite almost choked at talking about that. But, you know, it represents a workforce and a town that put their heart and soul into the thing, you know. So, yeah, for me, it's so symbolic and it's an iconic Aston Martin.
Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire. So find out more via amht.org.uk.